as part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series. Our guest today on the Not Old Better Show is astronaut and author Mike Massimino. Earlier, I reviewed Mike's excellent book, Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe, which was featured on the show recently. Today's interview is a companion to that, so please check it out too. Today we had a chance to catch up with Mike on his book tour while in Los Angeles, and Mike tells us in his words about the book, but more importantly, we learn about him as astronaut, someone who survives, perseveres, and thrives with great lessons for all of us, all ages, and especially those of the Not Old Better show. Please join me today in welcoming Mike Massimino. Well, we are with Mike Massimino. Mike is a former NASA astronaut and the author of a new book, a memoir entitled Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. Mike Massimino, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks very much, Paul. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.
Well, it's a pleasure to catch up to you. I, of course, was at the Smithsonian Associates lecture when you were present. You talked about the book. It was really great to hear everything that you had to say. I've read the book. I loved it. And I want to know, I know we got a lot of answers that night, but tell our audience, are we any closer to unlocking the secrets of the universe? Are we there yet?
Well, we keep getting closer and closer, and sometimes the closer we get, the farther away we seem to be. For example, Hubble, the Hubble Space Telescope, well, both of my missions were to repair, I went on servicing missions, repair and replace instruments on the Hubble Space Telescope. And most recently, discovered just last week, it came out that there are 10 times as many galaxies in the universe than we thought. So after all these years of studying the heavens, 25 years of Hubble, we think we have got starting to get a handle on things, and now we discover that, oh, actually, you're only seeing 10% of all these galaxies that are out there. And so it's kind of staggering. The more we find out, the more we find out that we don't know as much as we think, actually. But we're getting closer.
Okay. The other thing that I thought was really fascinating recently, and this was a direct result of Hubble's work, of your work and the team's work and all that Hubble has brought forward, and that was the discovery of water on Europa. And I just think that brings about, it's not just necessarily the discovery of water there, it's that we don't necessarily have to drill through miles of ice to get at it once we get up there. And that's a really significant discovery, right?
Yeah, that's huge. Europa, I think, has been one of those places where people have hypothesized that possibly we could live there, or we could maybe find some sort of life there. What we need for our life and to recognize life as we know it is water. And so the discovery of water in our solar system is huge. And it was discovered by Hubble, and it was discovered by an instrument that we repaired on Hubble that was broken, and we had to open it up, take it apart, and put a new power supply in. And so we're very gratified that repair worked and that Hubble's back up and working. That instrument was able to discover that water on Europa. But yeah, this could be very, very significant. I mean, we still can't get there very easily. It would take many, many years for us to get a spacecraft there, but hopefully propulsion technology will get better, and maybe we can get there in a reasonable amount of time in the future.
Yeah, and that's talked about in the book a fair bit. Another point that it came out in the book that I was struck by, certainly it jumped out at me as someone who's worked for the federal government, and that was your own kind of notion of service, of public service. Your father was a public servant. You watched early on how his contribution to the betterment of the world mattered. You went through undergrad, got a master's degree, a PhD. You know, all of this pointed towards maybe not space travel, but certainly public service is an important component to you.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting you mentioned that, Paul, because I wasn't really sure that was going to be a theme, and it kind of developed when we started writing the book that the notion of doing public service was a theme in the book, and it actually is, and it's been a theme in my life, and I don't really ever realize it because I didn't see it as doing a service, really. I thought it was more something that I just enjoyed doing. And then looking back at it, yeah, I mean, even when I took my first job at IBM, I worked in their public sector branch office. That was my choice to do that because you're working with nonprofits and hospitals. And NASA actually was one of the customers and the government and the United Nations and New York City. Was very interesting work, people to work with. And I just felt, you know, that it was important to do something that was socially useful. And I'm not really sure how that developed. I think you're right. I think it's out of my father, who was an inspector for the New York City Fire Department, and being around people like that. In my neighborhood, there was a lot of police officers and firemen, you know, the people who work for sanitation workers, people that work for the local and state governments. And you just had the sense of you know, serving the public good, doing something that was good. And you don't have to work for the government to do that. You know, you can do that in many different ways, whether you're, you know, a teacher or even an entrepreneur or a shopkeeper. I mean, there's all ways to contribute. And I think that that's the important thing. For me, it was, I ended up working with, being an astronaut, working for the government, and now I'm at a university. But I think there was always that sense of that, of, you know, living a life that makes the world a better place and how important that is. And I you know, that was something I think that I learned at an early age, and certainly comes out in the book. And I didn't expect it to, but it does.
Yeah, I noticed it right off the bat. I guess the other thing I noticed too about you was this tremendous curiosity that you have, this love of all things science and space. But the curiosity component, I think, is an important one. I think it's important to kind of maintain that all through life. And it seems like that's almost a neglected part of the job description, that as astronaut, you really need to be just kind of curious of everything around you.
Yeah, it's true. I think that I think that most astronauts have that in common. Some are a little more, I guess, directed, straightforward, not thinking about the bigger picture. But most of us, I think, all of us, I think, at some level have that. And I think curiosity is an important thing, to want to know what's around the corner. I think that's really what our job is about. I think that's what the space program is about, is trying to find out answers to questions that we don't, we're still contemplating. Things like, you know, is there life out there? Are we alone? Where did we come from? How did we get here? These are questions we don't have answers to, and we're searching for those. And I think that these questions are so big that we need to explore outside of our Earth, our own little world, to find those answers. And that's what the space program is all about. And as an astronaut, I think that's kind of at the core of it, is that that's what you're doing. You're putting your life on the line to try to answer those questions, to try to find out what's out there, increase our understanding and our knowledge. And there's a lot of other benefits that come from that. You know, we're the technology that's developed helps the economy. It's inspiring young people to go into science careers and to get an education. It's great for international cooperation, as most of our space projects are international, and I think will even be more so in the future. But at the basic core of it, it's trying to understand what is out there and answering those questions, looking into space for those answers.
Yeah, and the astronaut club is a tiny one, and you talk about that in the book too. In particular, you talk about kind of an astronaut reunion that's going on your first week of new astronaut training, and I thought it was a funny reference. You call it the Ask Can, I think, group. Is that about right?
Yeah, we were the, yeah, when you first get hired, what you're doing when you apply to be an astronaut, you're not really applying to the astronaut program. You're applying to the astronaut candidate program. It's a very subtle difference. So you're only a candidate. You're an Ask Can when you get selected. And then you graduate after about 2 years of basic astronaut training. You graduate to become a full-fledged astronaut. But when you first arrive, you're an Ask Can. And so and you're called the Ask Cans until you graduate. And then you're, you know, another bunch of astronauts eligible to fly in space. But until you get that training done, you're all Ask Cans.
Well, again, we're with Mike Massimino, author of Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. Mike, as I read through the book, again, I loved it. You see these names, you know, Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong, Megan MacArthur, John Glenn, Michael Collins, Sally Ride, Krista McAuliffe, and your name, and all of these others of, you know, kind of different backgrounds, scientists, thinkers, researchers, you know, different, you know, we've got, I think I read 50% of the most recent class of astronauts is now female. It's very divided equally. Are the doors to becoming an astronaut still open? Are they more open now? What's kind of the future for the program?
Well, I think there's always going to be the classic NASA astronaut, at least for a while. You know, it's kind of like we have military pilots and we also have civilian pilots, and they're both pilots, but with different type of jobs. And I think that right now we have primarily astronauts who fly in space or government people that represent the United States or Russia or countries of Europe, Canada, Japan, you name it. There's an astronaut representing a country. I think what we're going to see is more opportunities in the private sector for people to fly in space, either as tourists or as crew members on spaceships that are taking tourist places, or people who want to do research in space as private citizens, not necessarily as working for the government like we currently have now. So I think that is going to become more of a mix. There's going to be more opportunities for people to fly other than just flying for NASA. But as far as the classic NASA astronaut job, it is still there. They're going through a selection process right now. They had about, they had a record. I think the last time they selected astronauts 4 years ago, they had about 6,000 to 7,000 applications come in. When I was applying, it was between 5,000 and 6,000, I think, somewhere around there. This past selection, most recent selection, they had 18,000 applications come in. The numbers of the people that they need and the frequency of those selections in the last decade or so has gone down because of the shuttle program going away, but it's been steady, and it's going to increase, I think, in the future once we get more spaceships launching from the United States, which should happen within the next 2 years or so. There are already crews picked out to do that, to launch on a SpaceX or a Boeing spaceship, all kind of a joint project with NASA to get astronauts to the space station. Launching from the U.S. Currently, the only way to get there is from Russia. So what I'm saying is that, yes, NASA is still looking for astronauts. They will continue to look for astronauts, I think, every few years for the foreseeable future. But I think what's also exciting is there is other ways maybe to get into the space game and actually fly through these private companies that are starting to get real close to launching people into space themselves.
Well, take us out to space real quickly. Certainly at kind of the Hubble's level at about 350 miles up, there's a quote from you, and I just want to read this real quickly and then just give you kind of my reaction and then get yours. You say the Earth from our altitude at Hubble, we're 350 miles up, we can see the curvature, we can see the roundness of our home planet, and it's the most magnificent thing I've ever seen. It's like looking into heaven. It's paradise. And this is not something I'm supposed to see. This is a secret. I just thought that was really moving. Honestly, you know, to have that kind of engineering right brain, left brain kind of notion and thought for somebody that is gone through a program, NASA's program, which it seems from the reading about it I've done, it's very precision ordered, almost military-like. You almost decouple from some of the dangerous aspects, from the kind of the maybe the drama. But here this quote is, this majesty of the space. Do you recall almost your first glimpse of the Earth and your emotions and how it made you feel then?
Of course, yes. It was my first glimpse of the Earth came from inside the spacecraft, inside the shuttle, as soon as the engines cut and floated up out of my seat, undid my harness, and went up there to the window, the overhead windows of the space shuttle, and looked down onto the Earth. We were over the Indian Ocean, just into space for about 10 minutes at that point. Since our launch, it had been 10 minutes early that we launched into space about, and had a chance to go up there and take a look down and see how beautiful it was. So I certainly remember that beautiful view of the ocean, over the Indian Ocean. What you're referring to, I think, was from a passage in the book. I have several passages where I describe what I saw from the spacewalk. So now you're not looking through the window. You're looking through your visor, and you can turn your head and look in any direction. You can turn your body and get a position of anything. You're not restricted by where the window is. And that's out there. That's when I really felt the magnificence of where I was, of being there with Earth in front of me and seeing its roundness, and then being able to turn my head and see the stars and the moon if it was out, and everything else around me in the universe, and being kind of in between there, between the two, looking, was just incredible. And you mentioned the you know, the emotions of it. I think that probably on a, you know, on the scale of astronauts being able to want to communicate what they saw in those terms, in emotional terms, I'm probably on the scale of, you know, I really like doing that. I think, you know, yeah, the job takes a lot of precision, and I don't know if it's right brain or left brain, but if whatever side of the brain that deals with precision and engineering, that's definitely a requirement for the job. But there, you know, there are also, I think, some of us that are inclined to want to try to explain what we see. And Alan Bean, for example, is a man who walked on the moon and sells paintings. He's a commercial artist. I think for me, the way I saw my way to do it was to tell people about it. I love telling the stories. I was the first one to tweet from space. And this book was a way for me, Paul, to release a lot of those emotions and those stories that I wanted to share with people. And that's what the book has given me the opportunity to do, is to share those experiences. And it's gratifying to me that you hear you say that. It's almost poetic, I guess. I'm not a poet, but I felt like that's what I needed to be to try to, how can I find this? How can I find the words to explain this to my family and friends and to the world, that this is such a wonderful experience? And so what I did is I try to explain my emotions of what I was feeling at the time when I saw the planet. And it really is like looking into heaven. It is like a holy sight, something that is more beautiful than human eyes can stand to look at. And it's a beautiful home we have. And my relationship with the Earth changed during my first spacewalk when I had a chance to see it.
It changed almost, because I've heard you speak a little bit about this. You really came to embrace it more. You think about the Bruce McCandless photo when he's just kind of all alone up there. And but it's a beautiful picture, and it's almost, I really took that as being a very poetic statement of yours, and you embraced the Earth in, from that same, almost that same perspective, that of symmetry, and that it's really something we need to cherish and be a part of wherever we are, but be immersed in it.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the feeling I got. Yeah, that McCandless photo, what you're referring to, when he's in the manned maneuvering unit with the Earth in the background, he's away from the shuttle flying that thing, untethered, by the way. So he was under direct control to make himself a permanent satellite to the space program, but he was a cool cucumber. And I remember asking him about that. What was that like? They would never let us do anything like that anymore. We're able to. The reason they had that is so you could get close to satellites and grab them, and if you couldn't get the shuttle close enough. But what we found, we could control the skill of the pilots and of the machine, the accuracy of the machine, we could get close to satellites and just grab them. Didn't need to fly a guy out there on his own. But when he was flying out there on his own, that was pretty cool. And I've asked him about that, and you know, he said the one thing he noticed is that he got really cold. What's his own comment on that? That he got really cold being that far away from the shuttle. But other than that, he was fine. Everything went well. I don't know how I would react to something like that, but that was quite an experience for me.
Well, you're very open and candid about that. I mean, you're not real wild about heights, right?
No, I hate heights. I don't like them at all. I don't even like looking out the side of it. Even in, like, you know, I'm really glad that now at hotel rooms, you can't open the window, so I don't have to worry about sticking my head out or falling out of the things. So I like that, and I don't even like looking over the edge of a building. I just don't like it. I don't like heights. I'm not a thrill seeker. I will never parachute unless the airplane is on fire and I have a parachute needed to save my life. I'm not a thrill seeker at all. But being an astronaut was different. And luckily, it did not invoke my fear of heights. Flying in an airplane nor flying in space did not panic me into my fear of heights at all. So I was very grateful for that. But yes, I do not like heights.
Well, the book is wonderful, of course. I think there's a couple of lessons, certainly, for all of us. And I was struck by this notion of perseverance by you, that you pursued a dream. You pursued this several times with NASA. You picked yourself up. You know, you didn't necessarily worry about a bunch of appearances. You started over. You knew that being rejected for eyesight was going to be a challenge, but you were going to overcome it. You were just going to train yourself to kind of deal with some of these things in your candidacy. And there were people in your life who helped you too. That yes, you were able to make you were over, able to overcome some of this stuff, but it was really because of some of the people and their support.
Yeah, absolutely. I think throughout my life, and what you find in the book, and what I think is very important, is our personal relationships. And those relationships come in different forms and at different times in my life. You know, at first, as a young person, it was, you know, the teachers that helped me in high school. And in college, it was a mentor that I met when I was working, a man by the name of Jim McDonald, who I met after an internship. I was working an internship after my junior year at Columbia, and TAs at Columbia, teaching assistants at Columbia, some of my friends that helped me. And later on in grad school was my lab mates, some of my lab mates who helped me after I failed my qualifying exam. And then as an astronaut, it was my astronaut colleagues and some of the instructors that helped me overcome some things that weren't going well. And getting into the astronaut program with my eyesight, it was some very, very dedicated eye doctors, some optometrists who helped me see better. Under the regulations that NASA had, they didn't accept LASIK or these other procedures. I just had to learn to see the eye chart better through vision training, and was able to get over that. And I think on the other hand, you know, trying to turn back around and help people. You know, what I found is these people came into my life to help me from time to time when I needed help, but I was also willing to take that help. And I think sometimes that's even harder. Mm-hmm. But for me, when I was at a situation where I needed help, I there were people there ready to help who came into my life. And I try to do my best at doing that for others, you know, through my job at Columbia as a professor and at the Intrepid Sea Air and Space Museum. I come into contact with a lot of young people. And also with my job at Columbia, it gives me the opportunity to speak to a lot of young people at high schools around the country and sharing my story with them. And then when I do, on occasion, have an opportunity to help a young person directly, usually a student at Columbia, I try to do my best at doing that.
Yeah, it's very valuable. And certainly the work, your book, all of that's very valuable. I found you online many, many places, including Columbia University and your Star Talk Radio with Neil deGrasse Tyson. But maybe you can tell us what's in store for you on the Big Bang Theory.
I don't know. I'm going. The Big Bang Theory has been, you know, it was one of these things I kind of stepped into. Didn't really know much about the show when I first was contacted through NASA. They contacted NASA. They wanted to speak to an astronaut, and I was lucky enough to be the astronaut NASA picked to do that. And I think part of it is because what we talked about earlier, that I enjoy talking about my experience of flying in space, and I'm not going to hold back, and I'll usually tell it in a very positive fashion, but very truthfully and heartfelt, I think, is what I try to do. And anyway, I got the assignment to speak to these writers and producers at the show about my experiences. And after doing that, giving them some help on a script through my NASA job, they reached out again and said, would you like to come in for a cameo? And I was like, sure, that sounds like fun. So luckily I didn't have to go through any auditions or anything like that. They just wrote the part for me, and I went in there and did it. And then that led to 5 more appearances on the show. I'm going by to see, I'm in LA right now talking to you, and I'm going there this afternoon for a visit, to visit with the cast and the crew and the producers and writers. I'm really looking forward to it. It's become like another family for me. You know, I have my own family, and then I have my NASA family, and I also have the Big Bang Theory family, so I'm looking forward to seeing all of them today.
Well, we will look forward to seeing you on the Big Bang Theory in the future. We're going to...
I hope.
Yes, absolutely.
I hope so. Hope to have you
talk
back.
Talk it up. Yep. I hope they do, too, and plenty of your fans will want the same. But thank you so much for your time today, Mike. It's been a pleasure. Enjoy California, and come home safely, and please keep us posted as to how you're doing, and we certainly are going to share the great work from your book, again, Spaceman, an Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. It's out now, and Mike, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Paul, thank you, and to all your listeners, thanks for listening and hanging in there for the whole interview, and I hope everyone that gets the book, gets their hands on it, enjoys it. I wrote it to share my experiences, and so far it seems like people are enjoying it. Like, your very kind words, I appreciate. And thanks so much for your time.
Thanks again, Mike. We're going to share it widely.
All right, Paul, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks to all my guests today, all the help on the podcast, and especially to Media Studio Edit, and the great work by Wayne Brown and his team for editing the podcast and making me sound so much better. That is to say, not old, but better. Thanks to all.